It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, as we discussed in depth recently on this program, rural Americans are now dying of COVID at more than twice the rate of their urban counterparts. It's a divide that health experts say is likely to widen as access to medical care shrinks for this population. It's a population that tends to be older, sicker, heavier, poorer, and less vaccinated. Well, this half hour, we want to discuss other widening disparities in our country's health system, specifically disparities in cancer. It turns out that there are remarkable similarities between the cancer and also other health disparities experienced by inner city and rural underserved populations. Let's explore this with two nationally known cancer experts. Dr. George Wiener is director of the Holden Comprehensive Cancer Center at the University of Iowa. Dr. Wiener, welcome to the program. Welcome back, I should say.
Glad to be with you.
And Dr. Rob Wynn is director and Lipman Chair in Oncology at the Massey Cancer Center at Virginia Commonwealth University, and that's in Richmond. Dr. Wynn, welcome to you.
Great being with you.
This is very interesting to compare these populations. You use a recent op-ed there to talk about it. I want that to be our jumping off point and to talk a little bit about what the points you want to make about these two populations. Perhaps, Dr. Wiener, we could start off by making sure we know how we're defining these two groups when we say underserved rural and inner city.
Well, there are populations in various communities that are basically underserved in many ways. And they suffer from what we call social determinants of disease or social determinants of cancer. And these are folks who don't have access to care, who don't have access to healthy foods, who don't have the educational background to understand how to pursue a healthy lifestyle. And what we've discovered is that there are remarkable similarities in populations in rural underserved communities and in urban underserved communities related to the social determinants of disease.
Mm-hmm. So, Dr. Wynn, pick up there. You are a nationally recognized expert in cancer disparities. What points do you want to make here?
Yeah, I think that we sometimes forget that we live in a world of silos. So I tell people that, you know, if you look on the south side of Chicago or you look in Beattyville, Kentucky, or some rural places in Iowa, they're more similar in the context of their poor outcomes from cancer. And interestingly enough, when you opened up with the fact that now two times more folks in the rural communities are dying from COVID, they're very similar in COVID. There was this interesting report that came out, I believe, in the Washington Post recently that looked at this intersection between COVID and cancer and recognized that at-risk populations like African-Americans and urban underserved areas are definitely dying more from cancer as the impact of COVID is still rearing and will likely continue to die in higher numbers. But I actually would put money on it that that's actually going to be true for rural communities as well, particularly rural communities here in Virginia, I'm certain in Iowa and other places.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Wynn, so what is the connection there that doesn't, for non-medical people, we would wonder what does COVID, this pandemic, have to do with increasing cancer?
Yeah, I think in some ways, the easy answer is that I think many people were frightened from coming to the hospital, at least initially. And so they were either not getting the care or not getting screening. I think there's going to be a big effort. There will have to be a big effort of getting people and gaining people's trust and getting people to get screened. I think that's the best opportunity we have for catching cancer early. And the truth of the matter is, I think as a result of having to make some tough decisions during the peak of the of this pandemic, of having to put surgeries off or having to do things differently, also has actually contributed probably to more people not coming to the hospital, not people getting screened. I think as we're moving through COVID, the next big C is getting cancer back on the minds of people, because unlike in the 1960s and 70s, we can actually do things for your cancer if we catch it early.
Dr. Wiener, pick up on that, because you at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, we know across Iowa and certainly at the UI hospitals, there have been at various times in this pandemic, the ICUs, and there have been a lot of full cancer, well, full areas in the hospital, and patients having to be moved around to make room for COVID patients. How has that perhaps affected along the lines of what Dr. Wynn just said?
Well, we've continued to provide cancer care for those with a cancer that was diagnosed. That didn't slow down during the pandemic. But as Rob said, what we have seen is a dramatic drop in people coming in to get cancer screening done, to get colonoscopies done, to get mammograms done. And we actually haven't seen that fully rebound yet. And our big concern is that particularly for these underserved communities, that by the time these folks find the cancer, it's going to be more advanced and much harder to treat. So we haven't seen this big rush of more advanced cancers, but because we're not detecting cancers earlier, we are worried in the next 6 months or so that we're going to start to see that. And again, it's mostly in the population of people who were struggling to get access to care.
You know, it's funny, George, you say that. I was thinking about a recent paper article, and I think it's JAMA Oncology, where they said roughly, if you look at the impact of people not being screened for the treatable cancers, the prostate, the GI, the breast, that almost over 9 million people that should have been screened have not been screened. And that's an impressive number. And you think about that, that's just looking at prostate, breast, and colon. What about lung and some of these other things? And so, you know, I really worry about our areas, not only in Richmond and in Virginia, you know, the urban areas, but I worry about our Danville, our Brunswick. And in Iowa, I think it was Onawa is one of the poorest areas in Iowa. And I started looking at their cancer, you know, ability to get screened, and it's frightening.
Yep. There are particular challenges, actually, for those populations that are both rural and minority. And, you know, in Iowa, that might be some of the migrant farmers. In Virginia, that might be some of the African-American rural poor, that not only do they have difficulty in the distance, but they have all the other challenges that are also experienced in the city.
I see mentioned in your paper as well, food and food deserts. Dr. Wynn, expand on that, because some of us may need reminding. What is a food desert? Where do they exist? Do they exist in rural and urban environments as well?
You know, I have to readily admit that and be completely transparent. When initially I was thinking about food deserts, I had that in my mind of some areas on the south side of Chicago, meaning, for example, that there was not access to fresh fruits, vegetables, that there wasn't really even access to, you know, the fresh meats and all the rest of these other things, that ultimately you had access maybe to the, you know, to maybe the McDonald's if you were lucky. It turns out that I was wrong, that if you look at places in Virginia, Ohio, and even in Iowa, that rural areas also, just like the south side and west sides of Chicago, also have areas where they don't have access to all that fresh stuff. There aren't really all these farmer markets. It's funny to me that people will go to farmer markets to sell things, but in some of those same neighborhoods, in those communities, they don't have access to fresh fruits or vegetables. It's really an interesting phenomena that's happening all across the country.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Wiener, such irony there that we're in an ag state and we have food deserts also in our rural ag communities?
We do, where, again, access to the healthy foods that Rob talked about are just very limited. And in both the inner city and some of the rural poor community, the rural poor communities, they're just getting the healthy foods is difficult. They're more expensive. People have to travel further to get them. Transportation is another very interesting parallel. Even though the distances and miles are different between the inner city and the rural challenges, the underlying challenge is the same, that traveling to get cancer care, traveling to get cancer screening is an incredible challenge for folks, both in the inner city, where they might have to take three buses and transfer and spend hours doing it, versus a rural community where there's just no way to get to the medical center. And this has limited both communities from getting screening.
George, you know what I love about what you just said was that, you know, everyone talks about social determinants of health as if hashtag, right? So they talk about food insecurity and housing insecurity. But the one thing I think we all can agree on is that as health systems, we certainly can do things about transportation. And the other things that we certainly can't do anything about, but we should be advocates for, is broadband. For me, it seems that getting from people to A to B, if we could simply do that, what was the, I think the American Cancer Society had put out something like over something like 4 million people a year wind up having poor outcomes simply because they couldn't get care. Transportation, and that transportation really is a social determinant of health that's usually connected to other things. So if you don't have good traveling or good transportation, you probably don't have some of these other things as well. And I think it's high time that as health systems and as people who are really committed to public health, that we pay more attention to transportation in urban areas, particularly urban underserved and rural areas, because I think that if we can get you to point A to B, we can do something. If we can't even get you into our doors, we can't screen you and we can't do a whole lot of things. So I think the 21st century and as we get through COVID, we're going to have to think about how do we get to people? Part of that's going to be broadband, telehealth, mobile health. But how do we actually also get this transportation game fixed so that we can get people back and forth to get their health care?
If you've just joined us, we're talking about widening disparities in our country's health system, specifically disparities in cancer and what we can do with it. And amazingly, though we don't often think of it this way, the remarkable similarities between cancer disparities experienced by inner city and rural underserved populations. You were just listening to Dr. Rob Wynn. He's a director of the Massey Cancer Center that's in at Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond. Dr. George Wiener here in Iowa, director of the Holden Comprehensive Cancer Center at the University of Iowa. But to pick up on that point of transportation, we've made one of the silver linings of this pandemic, Dr. Wiener, has been telehealth. We've made strides we wouldn't have made, haven't we, without being pushed in this direction. And now we're finding that telehealth and broadband, it depends on good broadband. And thankfully, we're investing in that architecture, that infrastructure in our country. It's going to be something that we're going to use more extensively in cancer diagnosis and treatment?
Yes. And in fact, we have learned some lessons. So this is a tiny silver lining on the pandemic and learning how to use telehealth. One of my concerns is actually that from a regulatory point of view, some of the approaches that were loosened up during the pandemic are now starting to get more strict again as far as the type of telemedicine we're allowed to deliver, such as across state lines. So, you know, there are people in poor communities in Illinois that we care for. Well, we've had some difficulty more recently providing virtual care to those folks because some of the regulations that were suspended during the worst of COVID are being put back in place. So we need to learn our lessons and utilize this new technology to the greatest degree available.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some of the other commonalities between these two groups, these underserved populations, both in the inner city and rural settings. Dr. Wynn, what haven't we touched on yet that you'd like to go to?
You know what? This is going to seem like, you know, one of those previous Coke commercials from the 70s. I like to teach the world a sing type moment, but I have to say that both our urban underserved and our rural populations also have been susceptible to misinformation, disinformation, and interestingly enough, both in very similar manners, we're starting to see issues of trust. And I never probably when I started my career in science and started my career as a physician would have actually focused on this context of trust, but it's becoming, it's risen to a head now that I can no longer ignore that both urban underserved communities and rural populations also have an interesting issue with science and medicine and trust. And so I think we're going to have to start rolling up our sleeves, putting on our thinking caps, and figuring out how we as institutional academic centers and health systems can not just regain the trust, but figure out how we can even improve our own trustworthiness.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's such an interesting point, because let's just transport ourselves back to 2019 before we had any inklings of this pandemic. Would you, as a medical experts, have ever thought, okay, we knew a pandemic was possible, but then when we say, okay, what will be the biggest challenges of a pandemic, would either of you ever have guessed convincing people to be vaccinated, convincing people to wear masks, convincing people to keep social distance, because this is in part a respiratory disease? Dr. Nguyen, would you have guessed that before this all started?
No, wasn't even on my radar. It wasn't even on my radar.
Yeah, right. Dr. Weiner, talk about this aspect of it, behavior and the mistrust. Where did that come from, and how do we get to a better place?
Well, I think that the challenge is that people have difficulty identifying sources of truth, that the democratization of information that has come with the internet has had many wonderful positives. But one of the real challenges is that it makes it difficult for people to really figure out what to pay attention to. And part of what we need to do is to continue to speak about the truth, but to do it in a way that is culturally sensitive to the different communities. Mm-hmm. And this is one area where the language you use in an inner city may actually be different from the language you would use in a rural underserved community, but the message has to be the same, which is to really help point people towards the facts so that they can put disinformation that they're also being bombarded with in perspective.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Nguyen, we've always been aware of just non-science-based cancer cures and remedies out there, snake oils, I'll just say, for lack of a better word. But are you saying that within the last few years, when we've been struggling with disinformation, misinformation in other sectors of our life, that that has been even more of a problem when we come to diagnosing and treating cancer as well?
Oh my God, it's the most interesting thing I've seen. And, you know, it's hard enough just to take care of cancer, but it's even harder competing against Dr. TikTok. There are days where you're essentially saying you really do need to get screened, and someone's saying, well, you know, I don't need to get screened. You know, I just saw this on TikTok. That it is difficult and becoming increasingly more difficult to manage and to navigate healthcare. And now I have to be honest with you, some of this we probably is our own fault. While we have been creating scientific miracles, we have not always been connecting with communities in a way to ensure that they are understanding the science, or the understanding in plain simple terms what's going on. In fact, I'm reminded by, I was in high school once, and I think I came across this thing with W.B. Yeats, and who said something like, think like a wise man, but communicate in the language of the people. I'm not sure that as health professions have really reached the heights of immunotherapy and checkpoint and therapy and molecular targeted therapy, we've been fascinated with our science because we know the impact it has, but I think we may have lost sight of, as we were creating these miracles, we also needed to be able to communicate that in a more effective way. And so I think people sometimes get disenchanted and are looking and searching for information, but it's almost like that one song, looking for information in all the wrong places, though.
And I agree completely, Rob. And I would add that this is actually a really important area of cancer research right now. It's great for us to make these discoveries and develop new treatments, but if they don't get out to help people, we haven't served our purpose. So a very important aspect of research is health delivery research and communication. How do we take the advances we have and make sure that people in these underserved communities can benefit from them?
Let's look toward the future. And why this cooperation between this partnership between the two of you exists, and what you hope the future looks like in terms of equity in cancer science and care, and how we get there. We only have a few minutes. Dr. Nguyen, start us off.
Yeah, I think that, you know, this is really something that's been with us for a very long time. I see Cesar Chavez, Martin Luther King, when they got together, recognized that their struggles were more similar than different. I think in a similar way, rural communities, Beattyville, Kentucky, places in Iowa, places in Virginia, share in commonality poor outcomes of cancer and poor outcomes of health, just like on the south side of Chicago or in the Bronx of New York. I think we have to fix that. I think we have to get beyond race and get beyond all these other things and recognize that where you are, place and space really matter. And I think by focusing on broadband and getting equality or getting more equity and building infrastructures of broadband and focusing on transportation and just good communication, I think we can at least make a dent.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Nguyen, the last word to you, please.
Well, we can learn from each other. One of my heroes and Rob's as well is a surgeon, Harold Freeman, who recognized this problem and developed a patient navigation system to help inner city underserved people navigate the complexity of the medical center. We need to do that in rural communities as well. So we need to work together, figure out what works, figure out how we can learn lessons, take lessons learned in each community and apply them to all people who need our services.
Dr. Nguyen, very quickly, maybe a little brief comment on your background. Did you grow up in an area that was underserved and has suffered from some of the things you just talked about?
You know, that's why it's been so fun for me to be a cancer center director, because this is personal. I mean, I grew up, I was born from a 15-year-old mom in an urban area. And ultimately, once I became a cancer center director, I recognized that this fight isn't just one that's theoretical for me. It's practical, it's real, and it means something to me. So I'm in this to sort of look at the next 50 years, the first 50 years since 1971. We're celebrating our 50th anniversary of NCI-designated cancer centers. I think with Dr. Nguyen and others, we're reimagining what the impact of cancer centers can do, particularly in neighborhoods like I grew up in.
Okay. Thank you very much for this conversation. We've run out of time. Thank you, doctors. George Nguyen, director of the Holden Comprehensive Cancer Center at the University of Iowa. Rob Nguyen, director and Lipman Chair in Oncology at the Massey Cancer Center. That's at Virginia Commonwealth University. Dr. Nguyen, Dr. Nguyen, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having us, Ben.
Thank you.
Coming up after a short break, we'll discuss this pandemic's impact on domestic violence, also dating violence and teens in abusive relationships. I'll talk with two domestic violence intervention specialists. That's when we return. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in just a moment.
You already know you carry all of your favorite podcasts in your pocket. But did you know you can carry all of Iowa Public Radio too? Just tell your phone to play Iowa Public Radio, News, Studio One, or Classical, anytime for your favorite stream.
And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The U.S. Department of Justice estimates that 1.3 million women and over 800,000 men are victims of physical violence by a partner every year. Every 9 seconds, a woman in the U.S. is beaten or assaulted by a current or ex-significant other. One in four men are victims of some form of physical violence by an intimate partner. October is National Domestic Violence Awareness Month. So this half hour, we want to discuss the causes of domestic violence, how to identify it, what to do if domestic violence is part of your life or the life of a loved one or a friend. Joining us to do that, we have two people from the Domestic Violence Intervention Program serving Southeast Asia. We have their Director of Community Engagement, Alta Medea Peters. Alta, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having us.
Also, the Youth Coordinator, Emily Norvatius, is with us. Hi, Emily.
Hi, we're so happy to be here.
So happy to have you with us on this very important topic. Let's make sure, set a foundation and know what we're talking about. Alta, how do we define domestic violence?
Yeah, domestic violence or intimate partner violence is the use of
coercive control to control an intimate partner or spouse, boyfriend, girlfriend, any of those definitions. So to utilize that control and force to get what they want, often causing physical and emotional harm.
Okay, so it has a physical and a mental dimension, sometimes both, sometimes one or the other?
Yes, yeah. And then there is a third type, which is financial abuse. 95% of victims report, in addition to either physical or emotional abuse, also being financially abused.
Mm-hmm. Okay, maybe we'll get into more details a little bit later when we reach out to our listeners. If you have a question for Alta or Emily, or would like to share an experience, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Before we focus more on youth with Emily, Alta, tell us, in the approximately year and a half of this pandemic, and with it the increased social isolation for many, what has that meant for domestic violence?
Yeah, as the World Health Organization cited at the beginning of the pandemic, it is sort of the secret or secondary pandemic. Individuals, victim survivors, were forced to isolate with their abusers, and that isolation that the pandemic in and of itself caused for all of us, mm-hmm. Was yet another tool for abusers to use to control their victim. Our program alone saw a 28% increase in hotline calls starting in May of 2020, and we have seen that continued percentage of increased calls every month since then to date.
Mm-hmm. Alta, can you tell with that 28% increase of people who come in, can you recognize that this, you know, a case or two where this might not have happened had it not been for the social isolation from the pandemic? Is that easily recognizable in what you're seeing in those statistics?
Yeah, I guess what I would say is that not necessarily because of the pandemic, but certainly individuals waiting until the lethality had increased to the point of absolutely having to reach out. What we know with natural disasters and those types of things is that individuals sort of try to make it through, to get through that part and then reach out. And because they were isolated with their abusers, often challenged to reaching out to hotlines, made it that they would wait until the point that there were no other options, that they had to reach out, as opposed to prior to the pandemic when, you know, sort of the kids would go off to school, the spouse would go off to work, and, you know, Monday mornings we would see an increase in calls, mm-hmm. As they had space and time to have those conversations and safety plan.
Before we get any further in our conversation, Alta, is this a good time for a trigger warning? Can some people be re-traumatized by a discussion like ours, even though we're not going to get into too much detail, but that's probably a good idea, isn't it?
Absolutely. Definitely. What we know is that just about anything can be a trigger when it comes to discussing intimate partner violence. The ways in which cues and abusers manipulate situations definitely be varied, just as varied as people are. And so people ensuring that they are taking care of themselves and reaching out as they listen to our conversation today is an extremely important thing.
Right. And if you do find yourself being distressed by this conversation because of your personal circumstances, this is a good time for us to mention ways to reach out. Alta, will you do that for your particular organization? And then I can do that for the national access.
Yeah, absolutely. Those individuals in our service region in southeastern Iowa can reach out to 1-800-373-1043 and get connected with an advocate to discuss past or current issues.
Mm-hmm. And there is a national hotline, 1-800-799-SAFE. That's 1-800-799-7233. 1-800-273-3333. Or you can check out, and I did check this out, Alta and Emily, the website, thehotline.org, thehotline.org, seems to me to be a really well-designed website with a lot of different options, Alta.
Yeah, so you know, as I was saying, individuals isolated or everybody working from home, individuals with their abusers often have a hard time making a phone call. And the hotline.org does offer a chat option where individuals can chat live instantly, or they can text START, S-T-A-R-T, to 88788 and be connected with an advocate in that way.
Right. And when you are chatting online, I thought that was very smart to have a quick exit button on that website. So say you're having a chat about possible domestic violence and somebody in your household maybe approach you from behind, be able to see the screen. You can quickly exit that chat and avoid potential problems there. Emily Norvatius, let me ask you about the youth and domestic violence in that sphere. You are youth coordinator for the Domestic Violence Intervention Program serving Southeast Iowa, excuse me. I do international programs, so that slips out for a reason. How does domestic violence look different with the younger set, Emily, with teens, for instance?
Well, teens are starting to date. They're starting to have intimate relationships, and so they may engage in the same behaviors that they've had modeled to them, both by the members of their family and by the media and the adults around them. Kids start dating at a very, you know, young age. We start asking kids about boyfriends and girlfriends, and those behaviors, I very often talk to young people in terms of bullying behaviors and about how those, you know, behaviors that all children know can kind of be carried over into intimate relationships. It can be verbal and emotional, and it can be physical. And so, you know, having those conversations with young children kind of paves the way to have these conversations with adolescents about what healthy interactions look like. We kind of can look at unhealthy relationships in the media and really see them as being highly romantic rather than problematic, and getting the chance to dissect and talk about those relationships with kids is a really great opportunity that a lot of young people don't always have.
Mm-hmm. Can you, Emily, give us an example of behavior that someone might think is okay, perhaps because it's been modeled in a Hollywood film or it's just out there in our culture, that would be a red flag that you would advise a teen, let's think about this a little bit?
I would say the need to have constant contact and interaction. I talk a lot with adults and young people about boundaries. We all have physical boundaries as to who we want in our physical space, who we want touching us. We have emotional boundaries, and we have boundaries for how our time is used. With everyone having technology, having access to texting and instant messaging and social media, there can be an expectation of constant and immediate contact. You know, I know that you're online. I know you're interacting with people. Why aren't you responding to me? And so this can feel, you know, romantic in a way that I wake up to messages from this person and they can't stand being away from me. Mm-hmm. We tell each other every little thing, but this can be a way to control what a person is doing, and can be just a really negative, overwhelming, you know, that relationship can become overwhelming and all-consuming instead of having that balance in life that we all need between our relationship, our intimate relationships and the other relationships.
Mm. Such an important point, because so many of us listening did not have, you know, the 24/7 access to social media, these chats, these conversations, and that then combined with peer pressure. So Emily, in that situation, when you identify one teen is controlling another teen, what is the exit plan? What is the way out of that? I know there are probably a lot of different steps, but in broad terms.
Well, a big part of working with all of our clients, we're very client-driven. My job is not here to tell anyone what to do, even if they are a young person. My job is to help them kind of suss out what are my options here and what is it that I want. Because as soon as I tell a young person, oh, that's bad, you need to get out, they're going to put the brakes on. They're going to say, why are you telling me what to do? I care about this person. You don't know the good qualities about this person. And so kind of going through looking at the whole of the relationship and, you know, saying, is this a pattern of behavior that indicates, you know, a larger issue of power and control? Or is this maybe one boundary that we need to work on, you know, and is this something that this partner is willing to hear from? You know, because when a partner is willing to hear criticism and hold themselves accountable and say, oh, man, you know, that wasn't okay, I should work on that, then that's how we move towards a healthy relationship. When someone is not willing to hold themselves accountable or acknowledge bad behavior, that's when it's maybe time to say, is this relationship healthy? Is this what I want? And so helping that young person kind of move through those steps instead of telling them this is what needs to be done next.
Mm-hmm. And Emily, I suppose because we are dealing with teens, then adults may be involved, parents may be involved. So that complicates the situation, doesn't it, or does it?
Oh, absolutely. Because, you know, a parent is, you know, always going to want to keep their child safe, and they're going to, you know, they have the right to tell their child what to do. I do not. That doesn't mean necessarily, though, that kid isn't going to act out and push back against their parent. And so that may involve conversations with the school. That may involve conversations with the parent. It can get really, really complicated. And so having a place where kids can come and talk with a reasonable expectation of confidentiality is excellent. I let kids know I am a mandatory reporter. There is not everything that I can keep secret, but my job is not to tell the police or tell the adults or tell teachers on you. It's to work through this. So every situation is so incredibly unique that there's no one answer, unfortunately. We have to cast a wide net and get people involved sometimes.
Mm-hmm. If you've just joined us, we have two women from Domestic Violence Intervention Program serving Southeast Iowa talking to us, about how to recognize it. Alta Medea-Peters and Emily Norvatius. Alta, let's get to those warning signs, because it can be sometimes very hard to determine if you are in an abusive relationship. So how do you know? What are some of the questions that you should ask yourself in order to find out?
I think Emily absolutely touched on one of the important ones, constant contact. Where are you? Who you're with? Wanting to control all of those aspects. And then, you know, insisting that you stop spending time with certain people, friends or family, moving you into that isolation space of they are your only person to talk to or be around. And not honoring boundaries. I think those are two really big ones, regardless of, you know, teen dating or adults. Excessive jealousy falls into that as well. Sort of moving incredibly fast into the relationship, not taking the time.
I would just hop in to say that I think that the jealousy and moving very quickly are things that can be very easily romanticized in our mm-hmm. culture. It's I got swept off my feet. We're head over heels. We're moving forward so fast, and it can feel just, you know, butterflies in your stomach, overwhelming. And it we don't necessarily stop to take stock of everything that's happening. So just having an awareness there, I think, is really important. It's something that we call love bombing, when you're just absolutely inundated by positive attention from someone, and it can unfortunately become a manipulative tactic instead of, you know, just signs of love.
Mm-hmm. An abusive relationship can be dangerous to leave. What's your advice on how to get out of an abusive relationship? Do you always need to turn to a professional, or in some cases, can you take it into your own hands?
I would strongly encourage anyone in that space to reach out to an advocate. Having someone walk alongside you, just helping you to safety plan and see things that you can't see in your own life. In addition, having access to those resources and years of experience is beneficial on all levels. A lot of times that emotional abuse lasts much longer than the physical harm, and being able to have someone validate your experience to give you the space to just listen and talk through your situation is absolutely vital to creating a path out of an abusive relationship.
Mm-hmm. How can how typically are there different ways, or is there a typical way that an abusive person will react when you try to exit or put some distance in a relationship?
Well, we know that the first 72 hours are the most dangerous for a victim survivor when leaving an abusive relationship. We also know that abusers stalk their victims for up to 18 months after. So having safety plans in place is absolutely vital. Mm. Often that the situation escalates as control is lost. I would love to hear your thoughts as well on that piece.
We very much always believe that, you know, the client is the expert in their life, and so following their lead. Some people might know that police involvement is going to be a deterrent to their abuser. Some victims, survivors may know that that's only going to escalate their abuser. That's going to see, they're going to see that as something that, oh, okay, she's up the ante, or they up the ante. I don't care. I've got nothing to lose at this point. Mm-hmm. And so, like I said, we cast a wide net and see, you know, to catch as many resources for our survivors, our clients as possible. You know, do you need to relocate? What all do you need? Because you're the expert in your life.
And because we're coming up to the end of the hour, this can also be safety, a safe exit for individuals with children. You can get away from the person who may be threatening, abusing you, and there are, your organization can lead the way to finding that exit, no matter the circumstances.
Yes, absolutely.
We provide safe shelter to around 400 people a year, I believe, and about 200 of them are the young people that I'm lucky enough to get to spend time with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the only other thing I would add to that, Ben, is we also have a program called Cooper's House. So individuals with pets are able to bring their furriest family members with them to our emergency shelter. And we work with other programs as well across the nation to have fostering programs in a number of ways that we can keep the whole family safe. Mm-hmm. Programs like ours try to remove as many barriers to safety as possible for victims.
When possible or when needed, working with law enforcement as well?
We follow the lead of the victim survivor, and if that is a path they wish to navigate, we absolutely do advocacy in the judicial and law enforcement areas.
Okay, so this is a good time. We just have about a minute left. Let's repeat those resources out there. Whether you don't know if you may be in an abusive relationship, just have some questions. This is a place you can turn, a number or a website you can turn to, or whether you know you're in serious problems, this is where you can turn. To Alta, will you tell us how people can get in touch with your organization?
Yeah, our organization can be reached at 1-800-373-1043.
And the national hotline, 1-800-799-7233, 1-800-799-SAFE, or online, thehotline.org, and a really nice chat function there if that's a preferred method of getting in touch. Asking some questions. Asking questions doesn't hurt. Staying in an abusive relationship can hurt a lot. So thank you very much, Alta Medea Peters and Emily Norvatius of the Domestic Violence Intervention Program serving Southeast Iowa. Thank you so much for this important information.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This season, Garden Variety wants to help you flourish. Each week, our favorite horticulturists drop by with fresh tips. Subscribe and dig in. Head to ipr.org/garden or find Garden Variety wherever you get your podcasts.
River to River, produced today by Rick Brewer and Matt Alvarez. Jonathan Free was our engineer. Catherine Perkins, our executive producer. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.